morning, everybody. This is Emily here from the Willow Pod, and today we've got with us Skye again.
Hi, everyone.
And we've also got John here. Now, John's here to talk about his experiences of being in a domestic abusive relationship as a gay man. So, hi, John.
Hi, Emily. How are you doing?
I'm really good. It's really lovely to have you here today with us. So, just to start off with, this relationship was quite a long time ago, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. I mean, the relationship I'm in at the moment, we've been together 31 years.
Goodness.
So, gosh, it just seems like yesterday that it started. But yeah, the relationship I was in that was the abusive one was sort of from 1988, about February 88 to April 1990.
Goodness. And actually, the fact that you can even tell me the months, even though it was just a short time, you know, that shows that what an impact it made on you.
Yeah. I mean, it had a massive, really sort of fundamental impact on every part of my life.
Was this relationship, was it mostly coercion and control, or was it physically abusive, if you don't mind me asking?
It was all of that.
Everything.
Very, very coercive, very controlling, very physically abusive, mentally abusive. The full works.
In the 80s, I guess coercion and control wasn't really talked about very much.
No.
You know, so did you recognize that it was what it was, as coercive and controlling?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, it's like you say, I mean, it wasn't talked about in heterosexual relationships, and it absolutely wasn't dealt with or talked about at all in same-sex relationships.
How hard was it for you as a man to talk about having been in an abusive relationship? We know, again, in heterosexual relationships, if the man is the victim, it's incredibly hard for them to reach out for help, because men are supposed to be, you know, supposed to cope with things and be masculine and not, obviously I'm being very stereotypical here, but not show weakness. So how hard was it for you?
Impossible.
Couldn't
talk about it. Couldn't talk about it. It was only afterwards. I mean, the guy I was with, I left him about five times. And always went back. And in the gaps when we weren't together, obviously people recognised the signs and I was able to talk to people about it. But then, of course, he kind of wormed his way back into my life and I ended up going back to him. And back to the lies and the secrecy and the, you know, all that sort of that stereotypical kind of behavior of an abused person, where you lie to your family and your friends, those people you're closest to, you lie to work colleagues. It was very typical. Oh, I walked into a door.
Yeah.
Kind of, you know, which you hear so many times from people. Or I fell down the stairs, or I can't come into work today because I've got a migraine, rather than, you know, the honest truth was, you know, he just rearranged my face. So, you know, it was a very, very, very stereotypical kind of response from me as the victim, but also that added thing of being two men in a relationship. And we quite often see this now, that in people that we support at D+, that, you know, when it's reported, whichever kind of organisation, you know, say the police, for example, it may be seen as, oh, it's just two blokes falling out, rather than it's two gay men in a relationship. It's seen as, it's a friendly dispute, and that's what it's recorded as, rather than an abusive relationship.
Goodness.
And that's a difficult thing to deal with.
That must be horrendous. Yeah, just to let the listeners know, D+ is Derbyshire LGBT+.
Yeah.
We'll put the details in our information in our podcast for anybody who wants to access Derbyshire LGBT+. How did you get out of that relationship in the end then? Did you leave or did he leave you?
No, I basically walked away. We had split up, but it had been a very kind of messy split where we were living together, and I basically had to flee in whatever I could pack into my friend's car. And when Dave, the guy I was living with, when he left for work, I called a friend. They arrived in the car. I packed whatever I could in the car and left. But it was a very messy split. And when I ended up meeting up with Dave two or three times, and on the third occasion, literally we were in a restaurant and he started his usual coercive behavior, started getting violent, and I just stood up and walked out, and he ran after me. This was April 1990. He ran after me out onto the street and said, shouted down the road at me, "If you walk away from me now, I'll never have you back." And I just carried on walking.
Oh, well done. Well done. I'm guessing, in 1990, there would have been limited women's refuges and women's access to escape just generally. And then we know now there's very few male bed spaces in refuges anywhere in the county and very few in the country. So again, it sounds like you weren't particularly helped by any service.
No.
No, it was just your friend helped you get out.
Were there any services of like what LGBT plus do back then, or was it just sort of, in fact, were there any services at all that helped with?
We just need to tell our listeners, Skye's very young. She wasn't even born in 1990.
I know, well, I know now it's hard. There's obviously limited things out there. So I've just sort of wondered what there was at that time that could help you.
Ironically, I came across an organisation called London Friend, and because I was living in London at the time. And I decided I was going to go and do some volunteer work for them. And basically, they helped me to get my life back together again.
Oh.
I say ironically, it's because I now work for what was Derby Friend.
Right.
Running men's groups and, you know, and drop-ins and stuff, which is very much what I did when I left Dave. So I've come kind of full circle, if you like.
Yeah,
and you're
but yeah, there was very little support out there for men, but also male victims.
So what do you do at D Plus then for victims now? We're going to do a podcast specifically, but just if you can just give people a little brief bit of information about what you can do for a victim.
I mean, without wishing to kind of diminish anybody's experience. On a very basic level, we offer a listening ear service.
Mm-hmm.
And for a lot of people that we support, that is often enough that people just want someone who will listen to them, who will understand, who won't judge, and who can help them just, provide them with any kind of support and stuff that they may feel they need. So we do long-term listening ear. Services. We also we have a range of drop-ins and groups and things which are not specifically around domestic abuse but are vital nonetheless. For anybody that we feel may need more specialist service, that's when we look to organisations such as yourself, such as Salcare in Heena. Mm-hmm. And the Elm Project in Chesterfield.
So
back then, what would have you given to have had that listening ear that you're now able to provide people?
I would have given my soul
for
that. But really, I guess, until I was ready to access that support, and until I was ready to walk away and carry on walking away rather than having lots of messy endings and going back and all this kind of stuff, I really wasn't ready to access anything until really that very, very last time when it, you know, it had ended particularly violently. I'd had to take a prolonged period of time off work because the head teacher that I was working for, I was, you know, working in a primary school. The head teacher I was working for said, basically, I'm not allowing you in front of children with those injuries. So, you know, she paid for me to take time off and go back to my parents.
That's so nice, though, that you receive the help from work and stuff like that.
Yeah, work were amazing all the way through. I ended my very, very first week in my job. That was my very first school. I ended the week with a black eye and, you know, made up all these stories. A man in a pub, I remember this vividly, a man in a pub picked a fight with me. And you know, the kids were really shocked and the staff were shocked and whatever. And one or two would take me to one side and say, we know this was not a bloke in a pub.
Oh.
You know, but again, I wasn't ready to, deal with it.
No, absolutely. I mean, there's perpetrator programs now, but I'm guessing the perpetrator programs are for heterosexual males and not specialized, you know, for people in same sex or you know, drive programs for females as well, female perpetrators. Yeah, there needs to be a bit more specialized support, doesn't there, around.
There's not many organisations I've come across that actually work with the perpetrators, whatever their gender.
No.
So it's, you know, that is something that needs to be addressed. But again, it's only something where, you know, an organisation can work with a perpetrator when they're ready to address it. You know, there's still kind of, I think, so much shame involved in it.
Yeah.
As a perpetrator and a victim. That it's often very, very difficult to access any kind of support because you've still got that embarrassment and the shame and all that kind of stuff.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I was going to go back to when you said that you had sort of friends who knew that you were in that situation. Obviously, you said that you had someone who helped you move out. So it sounds as if they were very supportive with you. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so I got so much support from the people I worked with, particularly.
Yeah. So do you think if, say, you weren't in that situation where you had friends who and friends, family, or work people who were there for you, do you think that things would have been different for you? Do you think you would have been able to leave?
No, I mean, it sounds really melodramatic, but I don't think I would be alive.
Yeah.
I think because that final sort of incident was so violent, I was lucky to get out with my life. And I think had I not got out and had I not had the support and everything of friends who put me up, who gave me a room in their home to help me escape, I think without that support I wouldn't be sitting here.
I mean, domestic abuse, some bits are the same, what gender you are, what color, what you know, what any, you know, people need that support and that understanding, whatever, don't they? I was just thinking, and I don't know if there is an answer to this, John, but it might interest some of the listeners. Is there a higher incidence of physical abuse in homosexual relationships, especially amongst men, or does it not really make any difference?
I don't know any kind of stats for this. As you might imagine, it's difficult to get hold of any stats. You know, I can only go off the hate crime stats, for example. And there's an 80% of underreporting of hate crime in LGB communities. So, you know, if that is a representative picture of same-sex domestic abuse incidents, then there's an awful lot more going on than we will ever know about. And it's only when people leave a relationship or flee or turn to us for support wherever they are on their journey, whether they left yesterday or whether they left 10 years ago, we're still here to support people. That's the important thing. I think something like this takes years and years and years to get over, if ever.
Oh, goodness, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I still feel like, you know, there's particular songs I can't listen to. Was it Angela Black that was on TV recently, the drama on TV with Joanne Froggatt? I literally watched about 10 minutes of it and couldn't watch any more. So there's still things now that trigger me 30 years later. And again, you know, the man who came into my life, you know, in sort of June, July, August 1990, who I'm still with, was so understanding, so patient. Well, I'm getting emotional. Was so kind, and just gave me unconditional love, and unconditional acceptance, and unconditional understanding to help me heal. And I think, you know, I think if it wasn't for him, I certainly wouldn't be able to talk to you about it now. And I certainly wouldn't be, you know, where I am now.
Yeah. Well, he was obviously a keeper because you've kept him.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. One thing I was just thinking. So, John, if somebody who's in a same-sex relationship finds themselves in an abusive situation, who would they contact? Do they contact yourselves or do they contact the Derbyshire Domestic Abuse Helpline?
I would certainly say contact whoever you feel most comfortable talking to. At least with us, certainly what I find in talking about hate crime and supporting victims of hate crime is that people may belong to many different groups, you know, intersectionality and all that kind of stuff. We tend to find that people come to us first, so they don't have to explain what it means to be gay or trans or non-binary or bisexual or whatever. So they can just tell us about what's happened to them.
Yeah.
Then if they feel they need any extra more specialist support, then we would signpost them and we would advocate on their behalf and we would help them and we'd give them as much support as they needed to access this specialist support. So I certainly feel... you know, people come to us first, and then we can take it from there.
That's really reassuring to know that there is somewhere that people can go, you know, like you say, for that specialist support. Well, we could go on for ages, I think, on this topic. It's so interesting speaking to you. But we're going to do another podcast about D+ in more detail, so please listen out for that. But I think maybe Sky, I think we just need another podcast with John to talk about his experiences.
Yes, yeah, it is incredibly interesting listening to.
And very moving.
Yes,
very moving.
It really is.
And
it
like
is.
You say, even 30 years later, it's still as vivid, which I hope shows our listeners just how damaging a domestic abusive relationship can be.
So thank you so much for opening up and obviously speaking to us about it, because we know it's not easy to do so thank you for that.
We'll sign off. We'll sign off for today, and we will hopefully have John back with us again in the future. So bye bye everyone.
Bye, thank you.